friends. This one's name is Thimble. Thimble is a doll. Mr. Tor let this one take over the entire channel for him, or maybe he didn't let this one. But Tor is in no fit state to object right now. Anyway, this episode is about a doll. Oh. Hello, Mr. Tor. How did you escape on this lovely day? What?
Yoink!
Hello, friends. Thimble's right. This episode is about a doll. But it's about a lot more things, too. It's about love and loss and loneliness, codependent relationships, the refusal to grow up, and the refusal to let your kids grow up. I've never done an episode quite like this, and I'm not sure I'll ever do one like it again. Pull the bar down until it clicks, because this is going to be an emotional roller coaster. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Thimble the Doll. Yes, you're still my co-host. Next time you try to hire a hitman, don't hire Stretch Armstrong. This is Jollibee the Durian, as you know, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Months ago, my maternal grandmother died. She had a fascinating, long, fulfilling life. Here she is in the 1950s as the Portland Rose Festival princess. Later in the decade, she was a Pan Am flight attendant, back in the days when planes were effectively all first class, when a plane ticket cost more than it did today, even without adjusting for inflation, when flight attendants were seen as the coolest, smartest, hottest women in the world. She wanted to be a math major in college, but felt that the math world was too male-dominated, and went into home economics instead. A regret she only revealed in the last years of her life. She traveled the world both as a flight attendant and in her later years. Other than Antarctica, there wasn't a continent she hadn't visited. In her middle age, she ran a blood bank where she met the children's book author Karen Yakowitz, who knew my dad's mom, and Yakowitz set up my future parents on a date. Yakowitz went on to be the mother of the controversial health lifestyle podcaster Andrew Huberman. Yeah, that's the weirdest Tor lore drop you'll ever get. My parents were first introduced to each other by Andrew Huberman's mom. On the one hand, I'm family friends with John Zerzan. I've talked about that before. On the other hand, I'm family friends with Andrew Huberman. Can I have a celebrity connection that's not weird and controversial? Paul Erdős was friends with my dad's dad. I'm more proud of that than I am of either Zerzan or Huberman, but I think that proves that the answer is no, I can't. When I was little, though, to me, my grandmother, who I called Nani, was the woman who baked weird Norwegian cookies like krumkaker and sunbakkelser. It still isn't Christmas without krumkaker for me. And read me weird, creepy children's books. Nani had a Mary Poppins kind of bag full of toys and books, and whenever she visited, she'd read the same few books to me. One of them, of course, was by Karen Yakowitz, and it was the one I liked the most out of the collection. It was about a pair of Mexican farmers competing to grow the biggest pumpkin. The others scared me. One that was just total nonsense verse that didn't even rhyme and was full of minutely detailed pictures my autistic child's brain couldn't parse. There was one about a teddy bear exploring his emotions that came with wooden puzzle pieces with a set of faces for the bear expressing different emotions, and you had to click them into the book in the right pictures to show the appropriate emotions. In retrospect, that was probably a teaching tool for autistic kids, but something about that creeped me out too. Owl at Home, too, which I... And there was Owl at Home, which I just found sad and creepy. And then, when I was in my teens, Nani sent her stash of children's books to my family's house, since she no longer had any grandchildren who were young enough for them, and I began reading them again and realized they were classics. I still haven't found the one about the teddy bear that teaches you how to read emotions from people's faces, and I don't need to, but I love Owl at Home now, and I see how I didn't get some of the stories in it when I was like 4. I was always terrified of the Owl at Home story where Owl finds 2 bumps in his bed, which are actually his feet. When he moves one of his feet, the bump moves too, which makes the situation all the scarier, but when he takes the covers off and discovers what the bumps are, they're gone! Da-da-da! And in their place are Owl's feet. Owl is so scared by these mysterious eldritch bumps that he sleeps on the couch for the rest of the night. I was so little and so literal at that point, I didn't get that the bumps are supposed to be his feet, since the book doesn't say that directly. So I was just in the same boat as Owl. He has 2 mysterious, terrifying, moving bumps in his bed that he never gets closure on. And the book that I thought was nonsense and not the fun kind of nonsense is Rain Makes Applesauce, which I now consider one of the best, most beautiful children's books of all time. That's the thing about these books. They'd won awards and stuff. They're the sort of children's books that adults love. And in retrospect, I'm glad I grew up being exposed to them, but I didn't like them when I was supposedly in their target age range. But when I got my hands on Nani's stash of books, I found one other book in the collection that Nani never read to me. A book that I came to see as a classic too, but I understand why, even though Nani refused to believe that Owl at Home could creep me out, this one she knew was not something you read to a child in the 21st century. The name of this book was The Lonely Doll. It's from 1957. A mint condition copy can fetch you $400 today. It's illustrated with black and white photos that show this lonely doll making her way around town, moving through life, eventually finding a happy enough but shaky friendship with 2 teddy bears. When I was in my mid-teens, I loved this book. This was creepy in a good way. And it wasn't necessarily because it was about a creepy little doll. Way back in my Jerry Lewis episode, I talked about how our standard of what's considered funny probably changes faster than almost any other aspect of culture. Our standard of what's considered creepy changes faster than most culture, too. Consider clowns. In the 1950s, both elaborate, semi-realistic little dolls like this and clowns were considered wholesome fun for kids. This, check this out. This was a real ad from 1956.
Breakfast! I'm hungry! Take it from Carinkles. That's me. The best breakfast under the big top is Post Sugar Rice Carinkles.
If you wanted to market something to kids, you put a clown on it. Presumably, if you said clowns were creepy in 1956, people would react like if you'd said puppies or Bulbasaurs are creepy today. I wasn't sure if this was true, though. I considered that, well, since I thought all the classic Caldecott Medal-winning kids' books Nani read to me were creepy when I was little, and now I think they're gorgeous, well, obviously all media for kids is made by adults, and adults don't always have a grasp on what kids want. So did kids watching this in the 50s see it as creepy? I don't just have someone that old easily on call, but I have my mom, who grew up in the 70s, and I asked her, did you ever consider clowns creepy as a kid? She said no, and she said clowns were still everywhere in the 70s. If someone wanted to make it clear that something was for kids, they'd put clowns on it. My mom showed me this incredible picture of Nani running a fundraiser for a children's hospital in 1977. Here Nani's in her 40s and looks amazing. She's the one on the left. But yeah, this was a fundraiser for a children's hospital, and that meant clowns. I have a sample size of 1, and I know I do have some older viewers on this channel, so please chime in. Did clowns only start to become creepy when Stephen King wrote It in the late 80s? Or was it John Wayne Gacy in the late 70s? Was that the first time anyone considered clowns could be creepy? Or was there a latent cultural shift at the same time? People born before like 1990 sound off about your perception of clowns throughout your life, because according to my mom, nothing about this photo was creepy in 1977. Culture is wild. And I'm totally fine with leaving the clowns in the 20th century. By now, clowns have basically become one of the canonical Halloween monsters alongside zombies and vampires, and I'm fine with that. We now gotta rehabilitate clowns. If you want to rehabilitate clowns, more power to ya. I personally don't mind that clowns have become evil. But I do mind a little bit that dolls have become evil. This change, too, was probably brought on by horror movies, the Chucky and Annabelle series, although I'm a big believer in the idea that media follows existing cultural changes rather than causing them, so maybe there's something deeper there. I don't know. I do know that I don't see Thimble as creepy. I do like both subverting and playing straight the creepy doll trope with her, but I fundamentally see her and her sisters the same way they were meant to when they were made in the 70s, as cute. By the way, these are her sisters. Azalea, Sutherland, Quines, and Myrtle. The gang is all here. Other than Thimble, they're all named after little towns on I-5 in Southern Oregon. Okay, I'll grant that the really little ones, Quines and Myrtle, are kinda creepy. I use these dolls for D&D sometimes, where I play an artificer who has a posse of living dolls that she built, and Zorka, that's my character, has to regularly tell Quines and Myrtle to stop saying extremely off-the-cuff shit, because they're just very curious. Thimble and her sisters are another heirloom that came to me through Nani. Through a commenter on my 50k subscriber video, I now know Thimble's exact origin. That was one of the best, okay, maybe the internet doesn't suck moments I've had in years. So presumably Nani bought the doll that I would later name Thimble for my mom in the 70s, so dolls like these were still being widely produced at this point. Anyway, one of the things that inspired me to create this D&D character in the first place was this book, The Lonely Doll. There's something deliciously uncomfortable about this book. Something that makes you go, who is this unique work of art for? It has its own particular melancholy vibe, with the black and white photos of the doll Edith interacting with the real world. It barely feels professionally published, and for a while, I thought this might have just been a project put together by one of Nani's friends, until I discovered it's a valuable cult classic. It's a window into someone's unique world. A world I'm not sure I would want to live in, but I'm glad I have a window to it. Edith the doll lives all alone in a big house until she meets Mr. Bear and Little Bear. The Bears seem to be her found family, with Little Bear serving the role of a brother and Mr. Bear acting like a stern but respectful father. While this probably isn't something a child would recognize, it's very strange to modern sensibilities how controlling of Edith Mr. Bear turns out to be. Edith lived all alone and seemed to be doing fine, just lonely, before she met the Bears. She's an adult doll, right? Are you supposed to see her as an adult? Are you supposed to see Mr. Bear not as a father, but as a husband? I ask this because the main plot of the book is basically Mr. Bear beats some sense into that rambunctious doll and good for him. Literally, Mr. Bear goes out for the day and tells Edith and Little Bear, "Now don't you get into any trouble." Little Bear encourages Edith to dress up, they make a mess, and finally, horror of horrors, Little Bear writes in lipstick on the boudoir mirror, "Mr. Bear is just a silly old thing," which leads to this page. "I may be a silly," Mr. Bear answered, "but I know when a naughty little girl needs a spanking." In case there's any ambiguity as to the intent here, the next page says, "He was right." And then, in the aftermath, Edith breaks down crying because she's worried that Mr. Bear no longer likes her and she'll be lonely again. In the end, they reconcile. Edith and Little Bear apologize to Mr. Bear. He accepts their apology. Mr. Bear doesn't apologize to Edith in any way, nor is it seen as something he should do. And they live happily ever after. It's one thing for the message to be respect your parents, but your parents can't just choose to leave you to fend for yourself. Usually. And the title of this book is The Lonely Doll. It's something entirely different for the message to be, girls, you're going to grow up to live like this, and you're going to like it. Now, a lot of people have looked at this book, taken the latter interpretation, and been like, Jesus Christ, the 50s. And that's not wrong, but there's a weirder, sadder third interpretation. It's not about respecting your parents or your husband. It's about reporting reality the way the author, Dare Wright, saw it. By and large, The Lonely Doll is a true story. Alice Dare Wright was born in Toronto in 1914, not long after the beginning of World War I, the second child of Ivan and Edith Wright. You'll notice some recurring names throughout this story. Dare's parents' lives had already resembled a gothic novel. Edith was born and raised in the steelmaking town of Youngstown, Ohio, to a working-class family that had once been rich. Edith's mother, Alice Gaither, came from an illustrious colonial-era American family, after whom the town of Gaithersburg, Maryland was named, and she still had wealthy relatives, but her own branch of the family clearly was not that. Edith's father, Sam, worked in the steel mills, like most men in Youngstown. When Edith was in her 20s, Sam caught his sleeve on a steel rolling machine in the factory, and was dragged into the machine and decapitated. By then, though, Edith was already the family's main breadwinner, because she was an extremely talented painter. By age 13, she was enrolled in an elite art school in Ontario, and by 17, she was an apprentice to J.W.L. Forster, who notably painted the official portraits of several Canadian prime ministers. By 19, Edith was attracting buzz in the art world and attention from Toronto's upper crust, where she met the stage actor Ivan Wright. Ivan had been seen as an up-and-coming actor around the same time, but not long before he met Edith, he'd injured his leg in a bike accident, and with no help from the medical care of the time, he walked with a limp for the rest of his life. Unable to perform most stage roles because he couldn't stand up for long periods of time, Ivan became a theater critic instead, and wrote mushy poems for Edith. "Will you tell me, brown-eyed dreamer, all the things I wish to know? Why in summer all is sunshine and in winter all is snow? Will you tell me too, my princess, that you'll wear this symbol ring? Violets with it entwining, first sweet certainties of spring." It's the thought that counts. If there's anything this poem reminds me of, it's Roderick's poem about how things were 100 years ago in one of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books. So what? They loved each other.
Anything for my princess!
Ivan and Edith married in Toronto in 1910, in a lavish wedding, largely funded by the commissions Edith was now getting to paint portraits of steel barons back home in Ohio. But the money rapidly dried up. There were only so many steel barons who wanted their portrait painted. There were only so many plays to review and magazines that would publish goopy love poems. It was just as hard to make a career in the arts then as it is now. By the time Dare was born in 1914, Ivan and Edith were typically living in separate cities, chasing short-term job opportunities. Baby Dare Wright and her older brother Blaine were passed around like hot potatoes between Ivan, Edith, and Edith's siblings for the first few years of their life. None of them were the world's best parents. Edith found her children adorable, but in an oddly inanimate way. By this point, Edith had discovered photography and carried around a Brownie camera, the first small, affordable camera for the masses, everywhere she went. One time, Edith went to visit her sister, who was taking care of Dare at the time. She found Dare unattended, crying, in a stroller. Her response was to snap a photo, later captioning it, "Crying. Isn't she sweet?" Edith and Ivan found a house where they could hopefully live together with the kids in Milford, Massachusetts, working as caretakers of the property for the house's owner, a wealthy New York sculptor. They moved in, but just a month afterward, it burned to the ground, destroying all of Edith's paintings. The family survived without injury. Edith was always certain Ivan had started the fire by smoking in bed. Edith and Ivan grew apart from there on out, although they didn't yet get a formal divorce. Edith took care of Dare, and Ivan took care of Blaine, and for the next few years they were mostly unaware of each other's whereabouts as they moved across the northeastern US and eastern Canada in search of jobs. In 1919, Edith learned that Ivan had found a new girlfriend and officially divorced him. By then, she and toddler-aged Dare were living back in Youngstown, Ohio, under the care of a steel magnate's 29-year-old daughter, who had once had Edith paint her portrait and sympathized with her situation. Edith was still attractive and a talented artist, and in 1910, she and Dare moved to Cleveland to find jobs there, a city that was at the time much wealthier and more important than it is today. With the way her relationship with Ivan had gone, Edith swore she would never let herself fall for another man again, although there were rumors she had affairs with men whose portraits she painted in Cleveland high society. Gradually, Edith began to amass money and clout as an artist, ingratiating herself with the Hannah family, a powerful dynasty in Ohio business and politics. Dare, now elementary school aged, had never had a strong friendship or close relationship at all with anyone but her mother. And that didn't change now that Edith was finally making money and putting down roots. Dare was homeschooled, taught to read and write and paint and sew and do carpentry by her mother, who dressed her up every day and regularly made paintings of her. Dare and Edith made all of their own clothes, made dolls, built all their own furniture, and painted their apartment so that it looked like a fairy tale palace they couldn't afford. Dare rarely saw another person other than her mother. Edith was well known in Cleveland by this point and had successfully cultivated an image of herself as an idle, graceful socialite who didn't need the money from commissions, but painted for the joy of painting. An image that was inaccurate, but of course, got her more commissions. But when Dare was 10, the Cleveland News ran an interview with Edith that, while mostly positive, described Dare living in her mother's studio playing with, quote, decrepit dolls. Edith took umbrage and took it extremely literally. No child of hers was going to play with decrepit dolls. She went to a department store and bought Dare the most expensive doll you could possibly buy at the time, a 22-inch Italian-made felt Lenzi doll, which cost the equivalent of $230 today. Dare named the doll after the only other person she knew well. Edith. Not long after, Edith finally began making enough money to send Dare to an elite boarding school, where she interacted with girls her age for the first time. But not much. She was shy and withdrawn and spent more time with her doll than with her classmates. Dare never talked about her background, but when the other students met Dare's mother, beautiful and statuesque and dressed as she always was in lavish homemade clothes, they assumed she had to be some foreign princess. Edith was increasingly a figure people looked up to. She had a studio in a skyscraper downtown with its own private elevator, complete with a full-time elevator operator just for her, to carry her supplies up and paintings down. In February 1928, through her connections in Ohio politics, she was invited to the White House to paint President Calvin Coolidge, who mentioned, while he was sitting for his portrait, that he believed women shouldn't have jobs outside the home. Edith agreed, saying she only painted to pay the bills. Around this time, Dare's blonde hair began to turn darker. Edith would continue to paint her daughter as blonde for the rest of her life. When Dare graduated from high school in 1933, her yearbook wrote that the perfect senior would have, quote, Dare's brains. Many of her teachers encouraged her to go to college. Edith insisted her daughter had no need for such a thing, and Dare spent a few years in New York, trying to make it as a stage actress, with Edith supporting her. Dare was never great at acting, largely because she was so socially awkward and lived so thoroughly in a world of her own creation. She was already acting whenever she interacted with anyone but her mom, so playing a character on top of that seemed like too much. Dare was mostly in it because she loved dressing up, just like Edith did with her when she was a kid, and she now did with her beloved doll, the other Edith. After a brief, unsuccessful period in Los Angeles, in which both mother and daughter tried to make it in Hollywood, Dare registered with a modeling agency. That was exactly what she wanted, a job where all you do is dress up. Dare was so beautiful and so well-spoken when she could be persuaded to speak that everyone she knew expected she would be visited by a constant stream of suitors, but she was so weird that no boys seemed interested in her, and she certainly wasn't interested in any boys. Except one, and here's where things get really weird. Dare did most of her modeling back in New York, where, in 1940, she began searching for her long-lost brother, Blaine. She barely had any memories of him, but had been obsessed with finding him for years, one of the few things Dare ever did against Edith's wishes. After tracking down people who had known her father, Ivan, she discovered Ivan had suddenly died several years before, at the age of 47, after finally landing a play he had written on Broadway after decades of striving. It had opened to scathing reviews. 5 days later, Ivan died of unclear causes. What you're thinking is most likely correct. Dare discovered to her surprise that Blaine lived in New York, just a short bus ride away, on leave from the Canadian Air Force. Since both Dare and Blaine were Canadian citizens, even though they had spent most of their lives in the U.S., they arranged to meet in Central Park. They were overjoyed to see each other again, meeting as adults for the first time ever, and they became so close that it weirded people out. Ivan's brother Austin, who was acting as something of a father figure to Blaine these days, later claimed that Dare and Blaine planned to get married, concealing their Canadian birth certificates that confirmed they were siblings. Wait. What? But there was a major sticking point in their relationship. Blaine didn't approve of the strong control Edith had over Dare's life, and tried to pull her away from her mother's orbit against her will. Blaine began financially supporting Dare with his pay from the Canadian Air Force, since money was the main way Edith controlled her daughter, and he began trying to find a suitable husband for her, since he hoped that too would help Dare realize that there's more to the world than just Edith the woman, Edith the doll, and pretty dresses to twirl in. So, during Blaine's Air Force training, he befriended a British RAF pilot named Philip Sandeman, from a wealthy family who sold port wine. And when they were on leave, around Christmas 1942, Blaine took Philip to New York and introduced him to Dare. Family members from Ivan's side, still weirded out by Dare, speculated that Philip was Blaine's, quote, hand-picked substitute for his sister, a man who was as much like Blaine as possible, but legal for Dare to marry. In Dare's room at Manhattan's Bristol Hotel, where she lived full-time, she kept photos of both Philip and Blaine, right next to each other. The two men went off to war. And now Edith came back into Dare's life, intent on reclaiming her daughter from the clutches of her estranged son. A wealthy New York friend of Edith's had a dilapidated seaside summer home on Maryland's eastern shore, so mother and daughter went there, living in the overgrown house with no electricity, dressing up to their heart's content in the ornate outfits they still loved, and taking photos of each other in various states of dress and, in some cases, undress. Edith wrote to a cousin of hers, quote, "Wasn't I lucky to get her instead of Blaine?" Both possible meanings of that were probably intended. Blaine and Philip came back unscathed from the war in 1945. Blaine bought a small riverside cabin in upstate New York and christened it the Isle of Pot, which didn't mean the same thing then that it would now. Still trying to get Dare out of Edith's clutches, he invited her to spend time with Philip at the Isle of Pot. Blaine clearly wanted Dare and Philip to get married, and while they were there, Philip proposed to her, at Blaine's insistence. Dare accepted, and she did like Philip, but she clearly didn't take the prospect of marrying him seriously, and didn't seem to show any real romantic or sexual attraction to him. Edith liked Philip too, but she was disgusted at the thought of Dare marrying anyone, maybe recognizing that Dare had a childlike understanding of adult relationships. Now she had to compete with Blaine for Dare's affections, so compete she did. Blaine had a cabin, and Dare loved spending time there, so Edith had to get a cabin to lure Dare away from her brother. She bought one on the island of Ocracoke, off North Carolina, and she would invite Dare there for the same dates that Blair had invited her to the Isle of Pot. Forced to choose, Dare usually chose being with Edith. At Edith's suggestion, she bleached her hair blonde again, using a solution she had personally invented, including actual bleach. On Ocracoke, mother and daughter shared one bed, and turned heads among villagers and vacationers alike by going about the quiet island in glamorous, often revealing outfits. Even now in her 60s, Edith was undeniably gorgeous, and so was Dare. In 1947, Dare and Philip publicly announced their engagement, and then, a few weeks later, unceremoniously broke it off. Philip, now working at a film studio in London, had been cheating on Dare with a co-worker's wife, and while it was never clear if Dare was aware of the affair, even though Philip had introduced his mistress to Dare as a friend over dinner, Dare herself wasn't sure if she was ready for a sexual relationship. When they met, Philip's mistress had compared Dare to a living doll, and that was precisely what Dare seemed to want. Her life's work was to dress up and look pretty. Not for a man, but for herself. Or for Edith. The next year, as Dare's modeling gigs became increasingly lucrative and high profile, she met Fenimore Cooper Marsh, a multimillionaire castor oil tycoon, who shared her interest in photography. Marsha's wife Mary wanted to divorce him, but only if she can get a good settlement and full custody of their two kids, and the easiest way to do that, thought Mary, was to catch him cheating. Mary knew her husband well enough to know he wasn't going to cheat, so she set up a trap to make it look like he was. She encouraged Dare to invite Marsh up to the hotel room where she lived to develop photos together. Dare innocently did so, and a private detective hired by Mary followed Marsh up to the room, where he allegedly heard them whispering and giggling as they developed photos. Mary publicly accused her wealthy husband after this. The tabloids milked the case for all it was worth, and it was the first time Dare Wright received media coverage, albeit very inaccurate coverage. The papers considered her a sex-crazed temptress who had led a powerful man astray. Dare treated it all as a silly game. She was innocent, right? So none of this really mattered to her. Mary settled the case out of court after nearly a year of back and forths, just a week before what would have been a major revelation in the case. Two separate gynecologists confirmed Dare Wright was most likely a virgin. As the 1950s dawned, Dare's recognition as a model rose and rose. She would invite her friends from the modeling scene in New York to come visit Blaine at the Isle of Pot, where many of them were weirded out by the amount of touchy-feely behavior between brother and sister. Once, Blaine, Dare, and a few friends were on a hike, with Dare inappropriately dressed to the nines, as she always was, and Dare lost an earring in a field of tall grass. Blaine spent hours trimming the grass with a pair of scissors until he found the earring. Not much later, Dare took a job as a photographer for Good Housekeeping magazine, her first professional photography gig. In 1951, Philip Sandeman died in an aerial collision over England while training pilots for the Korean War. Dare was surprisingly distraught, crying for days, even though she hadn't been in touch with Philip for a few years. In the future, she would tell everyone she knew that Philip was her one true love, that his untimely death had changed her life forever, and if she couldn't have Philip, she wouldn't have anybody. To this day, you'll see the media claim that as the reason for Dare Wright's lifelong celibacy. It's possible that later in life, Dare came to believe this herself. While working as a photographer, Dare did briefly try out the dating scene, but men were put off by how devoted she was to her mother and her doll, Edith and Edith, sometimes bringing them both on dates. Her closest thing to a long-term boyfriend broke up with her with the parting words, "Since you think Edith's real, why don't you write about her? Make a story. Make a book." Dare baffled her co-workers at Good Housekeeping, but not necessarily in a bad way. She had an air of glamorous mystery about her. One fellow model speculated that she was, quote, born in a seashell. Others spread rumors that Edith, who still looked much younger than her real age, wasn't her mother, but actually her lover. Edith and Blaine still hated each other and were still competing for Dare's affections, but Blaine was not exactly deprogramming Dare from the Svengali-like control of her mother. She effectively had two, strange, codependent, uncomfortably childlike, but also uncomfortably sexual, familial relationships at this point. Blaine was horrified by the discovery that Edith had never brought Dare a teddy bear when she was a kid, considering not doing that to be borderline abusive, and made up for it by taking Dare to FAO Schwartz and buying a whole shelf of teddy bears worth hundreds of dollars. They took them back to the apartment where Dare now lived and played with them for hours. They were both about the age of 40 at this point. Dare began to set up Edith the doll and the teddy bears in elaborate little scenes which she would take photos of, initially just for her own enjoyment, but through a chance encounter with an old family friend who knew a publisher at Doubleday, she was offered the opportunity to make a children's book. She put together a simple little story about Edith the doll dressing up to the encouragement of Little Bear and disdain of Mr. Bear. Mr. Bear spanks her, supposedly for being too vain, then apologizes for getting worked up, putting his outburst down to his spring allergies, and lets Edith put her glamorous outfit back on. So the original version did not portray it as being right. The publisher found the plotline too simple even for small children and recommended Dare put some emotion into it. Now Edith became a lonely doll, saved from a predicament by the arrival of the two bears, one of whom takes the role of her brother, the other a parental figure. Now the spanking was portrayed as completely justified. For all the childishness of the story and of Dare's real life, the fear of abandonment that underlies the book is remarkably adult. Even at the time, people recognized the book's underlying darkness. Published in 1957, The Lonely Doll made Dare Wright a household name. She was already becoming known as something of an eccentric, giving meandering interviews to major newspapers where she talked about how much she preferred dolls to people and repeatedly told a story about how once, as a teenager in boarding school, a teacher had misspelled her name as Bear Wright, B-A-R-E, which she continued to think of as the funniest thing that had ever happened to her. It may have been an oddly apt misspelling, as Dare attracted attention again on the island of Ocracoke when she and her mother took nude photos of each other on the beach. Edith went on the press junket on behalf of her daughter, emphasizing that she was the one who had bought the now-famous doll and claiming the doll was getting insured by Lloyd's of London. Publishers demanded sequels to The Lonely Doll, so Dare kept on taking photos of Edith the doll and the bears. A toy company bought the rights to Edith and began making branded tie-in dolls, which earned Dare a lot of money, but she never liked the company's rendition of her beloved doll. A copy of Edith the doll was presented at a U.S. diplomatic expedition in Moscow as a representative example of American culture. After a trip to Scotland, visiting castles and writing letters to her friends back home that demonstrated a detailed interest and knowledge of history, childish as she may have been, Dare was clearly extremely smart, Dare began working on a novel for older children. Inspired by classic fairy tale tropes, it was going to be about a princess held captive by an evil wizard. What the plot would be beyond that changed several times. It went through a few drafts that were alarmingly sexually explicit, with the main plot involving the princess turning into a toad so that she can fuck a toad prince named Rogaine. It surrounded the princess Lona, who had been kidnapped as a baby and raised by an evil wizard named Druth. Although Druth was clearly evil and had destroyed three kingdoms as revenge for a perceived slight long ago, he was a sympathetic villain, portrayed as trying to raise Lona well but not really understanding how to be a loving parent. The Prince Rogaine is still there in the final version, still gets turned into a toad at one point, and still under his peculiar name. The baldness treatment by that name wouldn't be invented until the 1980s, and a Rogaine means a competitive wilderness navigation sport where people have to work out a route between a set number of checkpoints and pike between them within a time limit, but that first became a thing in the 70s. I think we can credit Dare Wright with the creation of the word Rogaine, a name that happens to rhyme with another name in her life. Prince Rogaine tries to save Princess Lona, but Druth turns Lona into a doll, and she has to escape and seek out a witch who can turn her back. Ultimately, while Rogaine and Lona get together in the end for the requisite fairy tale wedding, Lona isn't much of a damsel in distress. She saves herself, while Rogaine spends much of the story turned into a toad. Dare's fairy tale, which ended up just being called Lona, reminds me a lot of Howl's Moving Castle, more the original book than the Miyazaki movie, although the movie too. It self-consciously applies classic fairy tale tropes and plays them straight, but in the service of an interesting, original, character-driven narrative. And it's even more autobiographical than The Lonely Doll. Lona was going to be a middle grade novel, but there were of course going to be photos. Dare would never pass up an opportunity to dress up and have Edith take photos of her. With the amount of effort Dare put into the photos in Lona, she could have made a movie, with Ray Harryhausen level practical effects. For a scene where Lona fights a two-headed dragon, Dare and Edith built a clay dragon with fireworks that erupted from its mouth, in the immaculately decorated Manhattan apartment where they now both lived. Dare and Edith told the press increasingly fanciful stories. Now newspapers were writing that Edith was born in Italy, although this could have been a journalist's misinterpretation of the fact that Edith the doll was made in Italy. Edith was born in Ohio. Edith was now in her 70s and Dare in her 40s, but they both regularly understated their age by over a decade, and people believed them because they looked the part. Lona was released in 1964 to a wave of publicity and mixed reviews. Although the weird toad sex scenes had been canned with the earlier drafts, parents still found Dare's photos to be uncomfortably adult for such a childish story. And if the story was supposed to be about Blaine saving Dare from the clutches of her overprotective mom, well, by the time it was out, neither Dare nor Blaine seemed to want that rapprochement. Dare had retreated back into Edith's world, becoming closer to her and further from anyone else than she'd been since she was a kid. Blaine saw her less and less, and sent letters complaining about how she was letting Edith walk all over her. Dare sent Blaine a signed copy of Lona, in which she scrawled a barbed message calling him a, quote, bilge rat. Dare kept cranking out Lonely Doll books, and they kept selling. On the side, she sold nude pinup photos of herself to rich men, taken by Edith. The publishing magnate Bennett Cerf made crude sexual advances to Dare, both in letters and in person, but Dare innocently brushed him off. By far the darkest entry in the Lonely Doll series was released in 1968. Edith and Big Bad Bill. This is the cover of Edith and Big Bad Bill. This is real. Even a damaged copy sells for hundreds of dollars today, so search your attics. In the story, Little Bear dares Edith the doll to go into a foreboding dark forest, where she gets kidnapped by an evil black and white bear named Big Bad Bill. Apparently, in the morality of Dare Wright's universe, good bears are brown, while bad bears are black and white. Little Bear finds Bill and pleads to him to untie Edith. He eventually does, on the condition that Edith won't scream, but he doesn't let them go. Little Bear comes to enjoy the company of Big Bad Bill, and Edith and Little Bear realize that Bill was really just lonely, just like Edith was before she found the bears. The book concludes with Mr. Bear inviting Bill over to dinner. Edith the woman kept painting. Her daughter's fame had brought her a renewed wave of commissions, and now she was doing portraits for CEOs, actors, politicians, and their children. Dare painted too. They were rarely out of each other's sight, and it was difficult to tell where Edith ended and Dare began. They would sign letters Edie Dare. In 1970, Dare started work on a new book, The Kitten's Little Boy. It was about a mother cat who's concerned about her kitten son's upcoming sale to a human boy. The mother cat insists that cats are feral creatures who shouldn't be owned by anyone, while the kitten tries to placate her, saying that really, he'll be the one who owns the little boy, not the other way around, because he'll have to take care of his kitten, and the kitten won't have to do anything for his boy. But the kitten's internal monologue makes it clear that he's just saying this to placate his mom, and he does, in fact, want to be a pet. The concluding line is, "Luckily, his mother never knew." I'll leave it up to you to interpret this one, because I think there are two diametrically opposed possible readings of what was going through Dare's head here. The book flopped, and publishers demanded another Lonely Doll book. Edith was in failing health, and Dare felt like she needed to keep making money to support her, although they both had plenty of money by then. Dare once again drew on her life, crafting a story where Mr. Bear becomes old and sick, and Edith the doll and Little Bear have to take charge, moving out of New York to find a cleaner, quieter place where Mr. Bear can live. Publishers didn't like it. It was now the 70s, and the environmental movement was gaining steam, so why not capitalize on that? In the rewrite, which used many of the same photos, Mr. Bear was sickened by the noise and pollution of New York, so Edith the doll and Little Bear dress up as hippies and protest in front of City Hall. Edith the human's paintings of Dare began to depict her looking younger and younger. Edith wasted away, hiding her aging with makeup and wigs that, in the words of the book I'm using as a source, made her look like a, quote, female impersonator. In summer 1975, at the age of 92, Edith died in her sleep, with her arms around her daughter, the same way they slept every night. Dare was the sole beneficiary of Edith's estate, inheriting about $100,000, which would be near $600,000 today. The Wrights still had friends in high places, and Dare, now 60, was invited to many Thanksgivings and summer vacations with authors and artists and people in the publishing industry. She wasn't completely isolated, but she was most of the time. Dare was a voracious reader throughout her life, and she sold off the hundreds of Edith's paintings that had decorated the apartment and put in floor-to-ceiling bookshelves with rare versions of literary classics. She had a detailed classification system for her books that made no sense to anyone else. During this time, she drank nothing but Edith's favorite brand of bourbon, and ate nothing but frozen dinners, specifically Stouffer's brand frozen dinners, a brand that, before it was in supermarkets coast to coast, had started as a restaurant in Cleveland, where Edith and Dare often ate when Dare was a kid. In 1980, she published the final book in the Lonely Doll series. Edith the doll was now kept securely in a bank vault and had an almost indistinguishable stunt double, who Dare had meticulously felted herself. The last Lonely Doll book was about Edith and the bears taking care of an orphaned duckling. They hoped to raise it and make it their pet, But once they've nursed the duckling back to health and it grows into its adult feathers, it spreads its wings and joins its fellow ducks flying south for the winter. Edith the doll begins to cry. Mr. Bear comforts her, saying, "Ducks belong to the water and the sky. You've raised a fine duck. Can't you be happy to let him go where he belongs?" In 1982, a West Virginia mother named Kathy Lawson contacted Dare, saying the Lonely Doll books were the only books her autistic daughter Natalie showed any interest in, and maybe talking to Dare and meeting the doll herself would bring Natalie out of her shell. It seemed to work, and Kathy and Dare began a decade-long friendship, by now possibly the only close personal connection Dare retained. When Dare's friends saw her throughout the 1980s, she constantly seemed not just disheveled, but bruised and injured. She would tell elaborate sob stories about being mugged and beaten up on the street. Considering that it was New York in the 80s, and Dare had a lifelong lack of self-preservation instinct and naive trust in nearly everyone, some of these stories were likely true. Other injuries were probably from accidents while she was drunk in her apartment. She began inviting homeless people she met in Central Park into her apartment to enjoy reheated Stouffer's dinners with her, many of whom stole furniture and knickknacks from the lavishly decorated apartment. In 1993, a friend arrived at Dare's apartment to find everything smashed and in disarray, and Dare lying on the floor in a state of shock. A doctor's checkup found that she had been sexually assaulted. Not even this stopped her from inviting homeless people to come and stay with her. Two friends of Dare began to live in her apartment on and off to make sure she didn't let in any more unsavory characters. By then, all the Lonely Doll books were out of print, but became cult classics and were inspiring hipsters rather than children. Sonic Youth bassist Kim Gordon was a notable fan of the Lonely Doll, telling the New York Times Book Review that she liked it both for the doll's outfits and, quote, "the general air of existential blankness." Around the turn of the millennium, a journalist who had grown up on the books, Jean Nathan, began trying to track down their origin, uncovering most of the story you've just heard. Before she could arrange an interview, Dare Wright died in January 2001 at the age of 86. It's fashionable to look back on eccentric historical figures and apply modern-day psychological diagnoses and sexual orientations to them. That's not wrong or evil. Those existed back then, too. I've done that a lot in previous episodes myself. You can go ahead and do that in the comments. You probably already have. I hope people in the future come across this story and say Dare Wright would have loved chirping back a freefing Zarby. But I'm just going to present the facts as they were. This has been the story of the Lonely Doll. Edith the doll and her bears are safe now, in a private collection. Edith and Dare are somewhere else now, too, and so is Blaine. And so is Nani. But I'd like to thank all of them for bringing me to the sad, haunting, beautiful story of the Lonely Doll, who outlived all of them. May the dolls live forever. Want